You are listening to Salam Media live from our headquarters in South Africa.
Tonight we are talking about Egypt. And the reason why we are focusing on Egypt and taking a closer look is we've seen this country evolve over a period of time, looking at the political dynamics that have been changing throughout the various eras and the various presidents that had actually ruled over Egypt. And when we look at it from the time of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Anwar Sadat, Hosni Mubarak, the brief period where Mohamed Morsi and the Ikhwan were in power, and now Abdel Fattah Sisi. Yet when we look at Egypt, it is a country in Africa, but it does enjoy an influential role in the politics of the Middle East. Central to all of this is the relationship with Israel, the Palestinian cause, and even recently we've seen the role of Egypt on the boycott and the action that has been taken against Qatar, where Egypt has thrown its lot in with the likes of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. I have an interesting guest tonight, and her name is Soraya Sepapul Ulrich. She's lived and studied in a number of countries. She has obtained her master's degree in public diplomacy from USC in Annenberg, and also the USC School for International Studies in Los Angeles. She is an independent researcher, a public speaker, a radio commentator, a political columnist, and a peace activist. So she certainly does come with a wealth of experience. And to understand what the Egyptian dynamics, the political dynamics of Egypt are, and to understand also why Egypt find itself in the place or the position that it is at this point in time. We're crossing over to California in the United States of America, and we welcome Soraya Ulrich to the airwaves of Salam Media. Soraya, I know it's afternoon there in California, or morning in California. It's evening in South Africa. Welcome to Salam Media.
Yes, it's morning, and greetings to you, and thank you very much for having me on your program.
Yes, an absolute pleasure having you with us. And you know, from coming from your background, and I know you've researched Middle East politics for a very long time, and also in detail. And tonight we'd like to focus on Egypt, a country in Africa, but playing a very influential role in Middle East politics, Soraya.
It is, absolutely, not only in the Middle East, but actually in Africa itself, especially under the current president, Mr. El-Sisi. And as you said, I do research extensively, foremost U.S. foreign policy, but U.S. foreign policy toward the region. And, you know, every researcher has a given perspective. And I focus a great deal on lobby groups, their influences, and my passion, frankly, is water. I mean, we talk extensively, researchers and analysts talk extensively, and they write a great deal about the importance of oil or fossil fuels, and attribute a lot of the conflicts around the globe, especially in the Middle East, to oil. But in my opinion, that's a bit passé, and what is more important, or it has been for a couple of decades now, is water. And we dedicate so little time to water and its implications on the people and the many, many causes of conflict. And this is why Egypt, speaking about Egypt, is so very important at this juncture.
Yes, it certainly is. And I was having a look at your article, and I just found some very, very interesting views during the course of your research and in the article that you had actually written, Soraya. And there was a quote from Henry Kissinger: you can't make war in the Middle East without Egypt, and you can't make peace without Syria. Now, certainly this statement holds to be very, very true. when we see Egypt and when we look at Egypt over a period of time and how the country's politics and the political dynamics have actually changed and evolved over a period of time.
Yes, that's very true. And sadly for Egypt, and the broader implications that it has, I mean, we can't just look at one country in isolation and think that a leader is good or bad for that given country. But sadly for Egypt and its neighbors, Egypt has had its share of heroes, and foremost what may come to mind is Nasser of Egypt, who was patriotic and who wanted to unite the Arabs. And now we have a President El-Sisi who is cooperating with Saudi Arabia and Israel almost against his own country and against, you know, it's the neighbors of Egypt and those that, in fact, share the Nile Basin. And I think it's very important to understand that, you know, if I may just refer to the Nile, which is what my article is mostly focused on, aside from the fact that El-Sisi handed over important islands to Israel, when in fact El-Sisi staged a coup against Mohamed Morsi, the Egyptian ambassador in Cairo called him a friend of the Jews. And Morsi was, not only he was very protective of the Palestinians and was trying to help them, but he was actually very much opposed to the building of this grand Ethiopian dam, Renaissance Dam, which would have carried, which is envisions carrying water ultimately to Israel, although this, you will find very little mention of that in any article whatsoever. And what it also does is it's creating a great deal of conflict with Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt, of course. And the fear is that although Egypt does get a disproportionate amount of the Nile water, which was awarded it under the 1929 treaty, but really Egyptians are very dependent on this Nile water. And, you know, it will have this, the building of this dam, which will be finalized, or it will be finished by the end of this year, 2017, will have a huge impact on the lives of the Egyptians. And for Morsi to have, for El-Sisi to have agreed to the construction of this dam, to have thrown his lot in with the Saudis and the Israelis, is quite mind-boggling. And the way the dam is going to be constructed, one would imagine that, well, Ethiopia will benefit from this dam because it will enable it to have more water. But the tragedy of this whole situation in that part of Africa is that the Ethiopia and Sudan, both of them, are being exploited by foreign investors into their farmland. I mean, when the images we see of Africa in the West, especially Sudan and, you know, other places, Ethiopia is an image of starving Africans. Yet it's got the richest farmlands, some of the richest farmlands in the world, and one of the biggest investors in the farmland there is Saudi Arabia, and they're exploiting the land, they're exploiting the people, and the Africans are starving. This dam would probably help starve the Egyptians as well. And incidentally, Israel is heavily invested in Ethiopia and Sudan. So what El-Sisi is doing here in Egypt is not only harming the Egyptian people, it's harming the Africans. And in fact, they invested a great deal, both Israel and, you know, because there was so much discrepancy in building this dam that it would have had so many repercussions. International Monetary Fund never funded this dam. And so Ethiopia maintains that it's self-investing in this dam. But of course, it gets a lot of grants and money and funds and in fact, sale of bonds, which are held by Saudi Arabia, and Israel's contributing generously. So when you consider all the dynamics of what is going on, what Sisi agreed to, in fact, when Mohamed Morsi was still in office, he said that, you know, the Nile water is the blood of every Egyptian, and imagine what would happen if 80 million Egyptians went without water. And sadly enough, this was being recorded, this was being broadcast live, which caused a lot of embarrassment for Morsi. But every effort was being made to stop the progress of this dam by Morsi. And, well, there was the coup, and we have Mr. El-Sisi, who has handed over sovereignty of Egypt, islands to the Saudis, which was the handing over of these islands. It's so very important, too, because in 1967, in fact, Nasser prevented Israeli ships from navigating through these islands, and now they're being handed over to Saudi Arabia with the blessings of Israel, who've been assured by the Saudis that they'll have freedom of navigation. But also the Nile water is being diverted. And El-Sisi is not the first to betray. He is, in fact, even in the New York Times archives, you have an article in which President Sadat of Egypt at the time, who was assassinated in 81, he had said that the Nile River could be a source of irrigation for Israel's Negev desert. And he said there's no reason that the sweet waters of the Nile shouldn't go to the Sinai and then onto, you know, Israel. It's just there's a little bit of literature, although not mainstream, about how there's always been plans to divert the Nile water to Egypt. And whatever is given, Nile water to Israel, excuse me, whatever is given to Israel and Saudi Arabia will deprive Egyptians and ultimately Ethiopia and Sudan, although it is made believe that Ethiopia, since they're building this dam, they will gain, not the people of Ethiopia, not the people of Africa. Yes, maybe a few cronies on top who are selling out the country and they're outsourcing its farmlands. 60-70% of the farmland in Ethiopia, in Africa, is being given to foreign investment, depriving the Africans of their food, much-needed food.
Mm. Well, certainly, Surya, I think from what you're saying is there is a new picture that is starting to emerge. And for far too long now, we've heard about future wars being fought over water. And from what you're saying, it certainly is proving to be true. Because when one looks at Egypt, it's simply not about the removal of Mohamed Morsi because of the Muslim Brotherhood and the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. There is a bigger picture to this entire saga that is playing out in Egypt.
You're absolutely correct. And not to divert from Egypt or Africa, in fact, the war that is being fought in Syria, and we can't go into detail today about that, but that is also primarily about water. So I think you're right in that water wars are very much here today, and they're so important that, in fact, the United Nations had held meetings, several meetings in 2006, and they're on about water diplomacy. So water is today's, if 100 years ago, the most important resource, and that which changed the dynamics of power and invited colonialism was oil. Today it is water, and as the Saudis have said, we can't drink our oil. You know, we're even using oil to create drinking water, like, which is what desalination is. And at the same time, we're really having a horrible effect on the environment. So water is so vital. Water is something we can't live without. And unfortunately, those that have the power and those that are willing to serve their own ambitions versus the people that they've been elected, or in this case, a coup, to serve, are giving away this amazing right to what is sustainable. Sustains humanity or humans in order to their enemies. And we, you know, it's really, really very regrettable. We're going to see very many more conflicts, you know, soon, if they're already here, but they're disguised under, you know, like tribal matters, or one may be given to the idea that there's conflict because there are different factions or different, it's over statehood. But if you look at the root of all these problems, is all those things do happen. And there are differences in ideology, and there are, of course, differences in religion and what have you. But if you look at the roots of all of them, if you get down to the bottom of it, water is such a huge factor in all the conflicts we see all around us.
Yes, and also I think when one tries to understand the logic behind Saudi Arabia, for example, spending in excess of $20 billion to overthrow Mohammed Morsi, and when one looks at what is happening now, Egypt throwing its lot in with the likes of Saudi Arabia, with the likes of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain against Qatar, and then we find these two islands that are being handed over to the Saudis, which tells us that there was a plan quite a while back for these developments to take place, Saria.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. In fact, when Morsi was overthrown, I did write an article about it, and I called it a democratic coup. It was very much planned, and in fact, even the removal of Mubarak was well calculated, because reports had it that he had cancer. He was, you know, America's strongman in the region, had health issues, and so when this was the start of the so-called Arab Spring. And in fact, there used to be the Egyptians would come here to the United States. They met with Condoleezza Rice to bring about this revolution, or so-called revolution. But Mohammed Morsi was never part of it. He didn't have a role to play in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. And I do dislike that term, because Arab Spring is the term that was coined by journalists saying we're going to have democracy everywhere in the Middle East, and it was an excuse for them invading or interfering in other countries. But because it's a better known term, I'm using it here. And so Mohammed Morsi never had a role in Egypt's future after Mubarak was cast aside. And it's interesting how they had all these people collect signatures, which would have been inconceivable in the time frame in which they said that they wanted Morsi out. You know, this, of course, was a coup, and American, Israel, and, as you said, United Arab Emirates. And I'm very glad you mentioned United Arab Emirates, because from my perspective and from the way I see things and the way I've analyzed them, United Arab Emirates is a far bigger threat to the region, to the Muslims, and to the Arabs and Africa, because it's got its a signature all over Africa as well. But it's hardly ever talked about, and that's because it's a deliberate effort to keep United Arab Emirates' role out of the region, out of the headlines. And in a sense, Saudi Arabia is being treated like, I refer to them as gladiators. They're doing all the dirty work, thinking they can hold on to their power, but they really are despised by the Western countries that supposedly support them. And Saudi Arabia is doing all this work, and eventually its time will come too, and nobody will be there to support Saudi Arabia or defend it. But all these countries have thrown their lot in with really, I just can't say enemies of Middle East or Africa. They're really enemies of humanity. And you have to feel compassion for the people that serve under these rulers that are just destroying. You know, it's inevitable that they say if the Saudi rulers are carrying out these acts, then the hatred that one feels will automatically be extended toward the people as well. And whereas, in fact, I don't know how many Saudis would support what the rulers are doing, or how many people from Dubai or Bahrain. Certainly, we see that there's uprising. So, you know, you have all these very, anti-heroes, these individuals who are sacrificing so much for the personal gain, and the region will suffer because of their actions.
Well, it certainly is suffering, and when one looks at the Saudi economy at this point in time, it's in somewhat of a shambles, and also with its total reliance on oil, and that is another problem for Saudi Arabia, and as you mentioned, a strong arm tactics, a gladiator role that Saudi Arabia is playing, and we've seen that out playing it out in Yemen as well. We're going after 0.1% of the Houthis. They've destroyed what, something like 80% of the country, Saria.
They have, and their crimes there is just unacceptable. But it's not something that would have happened without the blessings of the United States, without help from United Arab Emirates. Qatar also had a hand in it, but it kind of got ejected from the group. And I think it's very important to bear in mind, again, it's the footprints of the Saudis and the Emiratis in the region. And, of course, the United Arab Emirates, they have the notorious Blackwater training their mercenaries to kill Africans, to kill Yemenis, whether they're Houthi. I mean, you might go after the tiny minority Houthis, but the rest of the country suffers as well. And it's just, it's mind-boggling. It's really very difficult for me. I mean, I do research, I read, but I've not been able to understand or grasp the human mentality, this kind of mentality that enables so much betrayal and so much killing. And you know, it frankly leaves me speechless.
Well, and Saria, just coming back to Egypt, and you mentioned the era of Nasser, and Nasser strived obviously for Arab unity against Israel, against Western imperialism, and during the Sisi era we've seen a complete about turn, where Sisi is now he's basically invited the imperialists into his country, and as a result we see the suffering of the Egyptian people, but also at the same time the people of Palestine that are suffering the closure of the Rafah crossing and the stranglehold on Gaza, the biggest open air prison in the world. So this man Sisi has done a lot of damage to the cause of the Palestinians and his own people as well.
Yes, he has, and he will be remembered. His legacy will be one of complete betrayal. I mean, every person that is harmed or killed, be they Palestinian, be they Egyptian, African, he bears responsibility for that death, for cooperating with the enemies of those people. I mean, it's tragic. One cannot even put it in proportion what he's doing. And What a difference. You have one general that stood up for righteousness and unity and, as you said, defense against imperialism. And you have another one that is throwing a red carpet for the imperial powers to destroy his own people. I mean, once this dam is, the construction of this dam is complete in 2017, we will fully realize the harm that it will do the Egyptian people. And at that point, even now, it's a bit too late to turn around and do anything. It's just the effect it will have down the line a year from now, a few months from now, is quite frankly mind-boggling. And, you know, I'm not an Egyptian. I wouldn't want to be in an Egyptian shoes. But if El-Sisi, the way he's treating the Egyptian people, his betrayal, I don't know. I mean, how will the Egyptian people deal with him? How will they tolerate it? What can they do? But certainly if they stand aside, I'm not calling for arms and or uprising, whatever. I do not believe in interfering in other countries. But if Egyptians don't react to what's happening today, I think tomorrow would be too late. And I've said this with regard to the Palestinians. If we don't help the Palestinians today, there will be no Palestine tomorrow. The same goes for Yemen. The same goes for all the wars we see today. And unfortunately, there's so many sparks. You don't know which one to put out. And each one of them is leading to huge fire that, you know, there's just so much conflict going on by the colonial powers of the Egyptians and Saudis and Emiratis all participating, that you don't know which one to put out first. And the minute you try to assist one set of humans in one location, they light another fire somewhere else. So I think what we need to do, the best we can do, I mean, we each bear a responsibility in what's happening in our world today. There's a soldier that goes and fights. There's one who informs. There's one who encourages. I mean, we really need to really stop this nonsense before this nonsense stops us altogether.
Soraya Sepapur Ulrich, and we are talking about Egypt and the political dynamics that have been unfolding in Egypt. Soraya, just to continue, and I'd like to understand the role of the military, and we've seen over the years huge support, financial as well, coming from the likes of the United States of America to the Egyptian military. And the Egyptian military has enjoyed a very powerful position in Egypt, in the politics of Egypt as well, dictating to the governments like Mohamed Morsi, and where there were democratically elected governments in Egypt. Just your thoughts on the military in Egypt.
Well, the military in Egypt, as you said, is very, very powerful, and they, in fact, are in charge of most businesses in Egypt. So their muscle is not only the fact that they're armed, but it's through finances and the economy. And it's interesting that you should bring up their role, because, in fact, when they ousted Morsi, one of the contributing factors, there were many, but one of them was the long gasoline lines and the fuel shortages, so soon after Morsi coming into office caused a lot of discontent in Egypt. And interestingly enough, the minute the coup took place, the gasoline shortage or the fuel shortage disappeared with it. Also interesting enough, there were a lot of outsiders who helped the military, of course, get rid of Mr. Morsi. For one, the IMF, the lack of progress in dealing with the economy after Mr. Morsi took office, the fuel shortages, and the IMF delay in its loan just continued this unrest in Egypt. And it was just ready for somebody to come in there and take charge amidst all the mayhem. And the military, unfortunately, again, it's not the military that combated imperialism. This is a military that is as an extension of, this is what you may refer to as neocolonialism. It's a proxy army now that carries out the bidding of the United States, its allies, and whoever is willing to work in that capacity is welcome. It's making war possible. I mean, without Egypt, in fact, had in 1995, it started some uprisings in Syria that were being hosted out of Egypt as well. So, it's a very powerful country. It plays a powerful role. But unfortunately, it's not an independent country. I mean, you can have all the power in the world, but if you're a lackey or if you're not sovereign, you know, we think being sovereign is because we have an Egyptian who may be our president, or we may have our own army, a powerful army. But if you get your instructions from elsewhere, you're not sovereign. And, unless we're indifferent to other people's ills and what befalls them, and unless we don't care, then I'm sure there are a number of people who are very happy in Egypt. But I can't imagine for a moment, because Morsi was democratically elected. You can't deny that. So he got the votes. So it makes you wonder what happened to all those people who wanted independence, who wanted somebody to speak for them instead of somebody who serves colonial powers, who serves, who's given so much of Egypt to Saudi Arabia, to Israel, who's spending time harming other African nations.
Yes, and also when one looks at how things have developed through from the Nasser era to, for example, Anwar Sadat with the Camp David Accords, and we've seen what has happened with Hosni Mubarak and also with Sisi, where how this has actually played into the hands of Israel, where their political objectives and their ambitions for the region have actually come to fruition. Because I think this is very, very important, where we still see, as a result of Sisi, the stranglehold on the Palestinian people, and also, you know, Egypt just basically caving in or giving in to the whims and fancies of Israel.
You're absolutely right, and when we study U.S. foreign policy, and it's not just me that says this, and when I bring in U.S. foreign policy, because United States enables Israel, United States, in fact, without the United States' help, Israel wouldn't be able to do all the things that it does now. And many foreign policy experts, many international relations pundits do agree that the United States policies, its interests, it puts Israel's interests above its own. Its foreign policy is formulated to support Israel. So everything that we see happening here, everything that is going on in Egypt and against the Palestinians, serves the state of Israel. And, you know, and Egypt is fully cooperating. Egypt is on board. And it's interesting because Morsi, you know, one should maybe have some diplomatic decorum, but he did say it. He called Jews descendants of pigs, and that went down really poorly with the Israelis. And he did start to open up the Rafah crossing and what have you. So what Israel's role is huge. It's huge here. And, you know, and what worries me is that we have somebody like El-Sisi who's handed over the great power of Egypt to the service of Israel. And that does not bode well at all, not for the region and not for the world. So it's very worrying, frankly.
Well, it certainly is very, very worrying. And, you know, we've just seen in the last few weeks again, Israel obviously acting with impunity against the people of Gaza. You know, we've seen them going in, bombing. We've seen it happen. It's just happening over and over again, you know, where the people of Gaza in this open-air prison have absolutely nowhere to go. And their only lifeline at the time was when Mohamed Morsi had opened up the Rafah crossing, and, you know, there was some sort of relief for them at that point in time. But right now we see absolutely nothing.
That's very true. And one of the problems that Israel, Saudi Arabia, America, all these people have with Qatar is because Qatar does help the Palestinians, at least financially. So that's something that's not acceptable to them. And in, you know, it's not just Hamas that was overjoyed by Morsi's election to power, but even the U.S.-backed Palestinian Authority was happy. So Qatar supported them when Morsi was elected. Qatar did support Palestinians. And now they're sort of against all Egypt, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and everybody is against Qatar. You know, they could have picked any number of issues that Qatar might have had, but a huge part of it is Qatar's support for the Palestinian cause. And I think that's not going down too well with Israel.
Yes, I think apart from that, the support for the Palestinians, we've seen these demands of which Egypt is part of that have been placed on Qatar, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the support of Hamas, but also the relationship with Iran has actually come into question. The relationship with Turkey has come into question. The military base that Turkey has in Qatar, you know, that has come into question. So, you know, all of this put together, you know, tells me that, you know, there's definitely a lot more behind than compared to what we read in the mainstream media and what the mainstream media is telling us.
Absolutely, that's very true. In fact, the Qataris had Well, one of the interesting things that was said in Qatar was that they were questioning how long Donald Trump would stay in power. But Qatar is, you know, it needs to have close ties with Iran because they share gas interests. And with, I mean, Turkey and Qatar both have been supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, I can't tell you definitively about this, but I know this in the previous times, Muslim Brotherhood was exploited by the United States. It was exploited to rise up against Nasser to stand against Soviet Union. But the Muslim Brotherhood evolved over time. And in fact, they had very democratic ideals. So, you know, if you want to impose your will on a nation, you don't want democracy. And in the West, they see democracy as somebody who's, if a woman half naked drinking, they think that's democracy. But the Muslim Brotherhood did uphold democratic ideals. And the West doesn't like democracy because if a country has democratic rulers who picked or chosen democratically, if the people support their leaders, then the colonial powers, which, you know, United States, Israel, and the rest, they can't dictate to those countries. And so it's always important to undermine the rulers. It's always important to undermine the rulers who side with their people. I mean, nothing suits the West or United States, Israel, whatever, than a leader who is willing to betray their nation and put their lot in with occupiers. And so Qatar was trying to stand up firmly to some of what's going on. And yes, I mean, they did have relations with Iran. And of course, Iran, from the Israeli perspective, is the most hated country in the world because it does defend Palestinians. It does defend, it's not just the Palestinians. I think Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the Shah's Iran, does defend the oppressed people of the world, regardless of their color, religion, or what have you, or nationality. So Israel has always seen Iran as its number one enemy because it's afraid that Iran may encourage others to follow suit and defend what is right. So, yeah, Qatar is certainly guilty of having relations with Iran, having relations with Turkey. Now, Turkey is a bit curious here because it's always been, well, it is a NATO member. It has bases there. It hosts nuclear bombs on its territory, which the United States can use if it wishes to. So what is, I mean, one has to keep a very close eye on Turkey and see the developments there, because it's also very guilty of the uprisings in Syria.
Mm. Well, I think when one puts all of this together and one, and you, I see you've mentioned betrayal a few times, where these leaders have actually betrayed their own people and betrayed what the greater cause has been, which tells me that we have a huge leadership problem in the Middle East. We've seen Sisi, and he's developed somewhat of a track record. And also looking at Saudi Arabia now, where we've got this young Mohammed bin Salman, who is now the crown prince and who is obviously in line to be the king of Saudi Arabia. And all of this put together tells us that, you know, these are leaders that have betrayed their people, but they are going to be there, for, I think, for a long time, yeah, to continue betraying their people and, you know, for the detriment and of their own people.
That's very true, but then it also depends on how much the people can take. I mean, if you recall, or if your listeners recall, the Shah of Iran was one such leader. I mean, the Shah basically was the gendarme of the Persian Gulf. He served the United States, and he puts, I mean, the number of people he put in prison and tortured to serve America is well, they estimated it at 7,000 at one point in 1970. But finally, the people had enough. And I think it boils down to this. It boils down to whether a people, a nation, are willing to die standing, or whether they choose to be on their knees and live. And I think it's a matter of individuals making a choice, a matter of people's. And it's very easy for me to say this sitting here behind my computer in California and making this, stating this, because I'm not there dealing with it. And in real life, things are far more scary. Things are truly terrifying. But at one point, it all comes back to basic humanity, the basis of human dignity. And if we forgo that, then we have to forgo our humanity and not complain. If we complain about how things are, then we must take action to do something about it.
Well, certainly. And as a result, we see the rest of the world suffering. And we being in Africa, we've seen the consequences of what is taking place in the Middle East and the impact that it is having on Africa. And early on, you even touched on the dams out in Ethiopia and how that is going to pan out, or how that is going to play out as well. And coming back to Egypt's role in Africa, because Africa has to an extent looked up to Egypt as an African country, but the role that Egypt is playing, is completely opposite to what is expected of Egypt in Africa.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. And unfortunately, what they've succeeded here, and when I say they, I mean probably those that have invested interest in this, which is Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and with the push and help from United States, or the U.S. orchestrating all this, is they create a division among the countries. And when they create that division, you kind of get a sense of each man for its own. If I don't go along, then, for example, Ethiopia may say that if I don't work with Israel, if I don't build this dam, then I'll get even more hurt, or it'll cost me more, or Sudan will get more benefit, because Israel does invest heavily in Sudan, from infrastructure to arms sales and what have you. So Sudan would get the benefit. Why not me? And this kind of mentality of racing to be exploited, it's very natural. At the same time, it's one that if it's not checked, it will lead to ruin. I mean, as humans, we're often so short-sighted. We see what may happen in my favor tomorrow, but failing to see what may happen next week. And that's how they're able to exploit the region. They're able to exploit Africa, or leaders in Egypt, or even the Saudi leadership. It's really quite amazing. In 2012, it was revealed that the United States was teaching its military academy, its officers, future officers and generals and decision makers, that they should bomb Mecca and Medina. They should even starve the Saudis and reduce Islam to a cult. And yet these same people are now working with the United States, and they're working with Israel against other Arabs or against other Muslims. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, it certainly is. I think for a few years ago, I recall reading an article about redrawing the map of the Middle East, and we see that coming to fruition right now, where we've seen in the past, we've heard about divide and conquer. Now it's divide and exploit.
Exactly. Very well put. I mean, that's exactly what's happening. And what is painful to watch, and when you're not in a situation, you can see better perhaps standing back, and what is painful to watch is these little broken up states, tribes, countries, they're in a race begging to be exploited. They're saying, please come and exploit me. I'll give you better service. I'll be a better lackey for you. And that's what's so sad to watch. That it's so sad to watch, because we're dealing with some great nations here. I know during colonial times, each country has suffered. Yes, we Egypt suffered, and Ethiopia, Sudan. But these are all great, terrific countries. I'm not, and they're rich, for goodness sake. It's just that their wealth is being exploited. And yet they're all in a race to serve their own disinterest, if you will.
Yes.
And I don't know, short of waking them up, I don't know what can be done.
Well, I think it's very, very tough. And, you know, I think when we talk about divide and exploit, a classic case now we see is Libya, where Libya was once a very wealthy country, the highest standard of living in Africa people enjoyed. And we see what has happened with Libya, you know, how this country has actually been broken up and the disastrous consequences as a result of this division and the exploitation that is taking place, Isaria.
Absolutely. And speaking of Libya, seems that Libya is now working with the United Arab Emirates and wanting to form a military, at least, you know, have worked together militarily. And that's very alarming. You know, how can a country that was so advanced, so rich, lacking for nothing, after having been totally destroyed, work with United Arab Emirates, which is again working with its enemies? So, you know, I often when I write and I research and I say, what can I do? It's always, okay, so these are the problems. How do we find a solution to these problems? And frankly, the reason I did want to speak with you, and I think it's very important to build awareness. And people often say to me, well, you're not going to wake up the whole world, not, you know, how much reach do you have? But as long as even one person can listen to me and understand what I'm saying, they can disagree with me, that's totally fine. Open up the dialogue. They can in turn wake up somebody else, build awareness when we're at our worst, when we're just dormant, when we're not thinking, when we're not aware. If we are aware, I don't think if we had an ounce of passion or pride or sense of justice, we would just sit back and do nothing.
Yes. Saria, I think what I find very interesting is also the lack of unity among the Arabs. And there's a politician in the United Kingdom by the name of George Galloway, and he put it so well, right, where he told the Arabs, and he says, there's 360 million of you all speaking the same language, supposedly all obviously following the same religion. And he says, you know, you cannot come together, where he says, if you compare us in Europe, for instance, he says, we speak something like 170 different languages. Yet Europe can come together showing a sign of unity and in purpose and in many other ways. And you Arabs can do absolutely nothing. And this whole lack of unity, we see it in the Arab Union, we see it in the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference. And this obviously is another problem that the Arabs are actually faced with.
That's very true, and Galloway has said it very well and very nicely. And I think the problem perhaps stems from having a neo-colonialized mind. I mean, when colonial powers came and stationed themselves into different countries, they were unable to control each and every person. So what they did was they would have a system whereby a few, the elite, as they would like to call them, would actually put down the rest of the country. You know, it would reach a point where, I mean, I saw this firsthand in Iran. Whoever was westernized was acceptable and good, and the rest who did not follow in Western footsteps, then you look down on them, and it was often the elite that also had the money. So the rest of the country, which is over 90%, never had a chance for advancement, never had a chance to participate in their own country. And this division was a division that was deliberate, that was, the colonial powers wanted this kind of neo-colonial mentality to create a divide within the same, within the country. So if there was a divide in Iran between the people, if there was a divide in Egypt amongst the people, then imagine this division going, this crack going even further and encompassing the whole area. Now, Europe didn't suffer this because Europe was never, they were the colonial powers. They weren't colonized. So I think that's where we see the difference. And I think until such time that every person, every Egyptian, every African, every Iranian, I don't care where the nationality is from, until we take pride in who we are as a human being, We don't have to look like a Western person. We don't have to act like them. We don't have to speak the language. As long as we believe in ourselves, then we can reclaim our country and our society. But until such time, they will still continue to think that the other, which the other, in fact, is the ones that are handpicked by the colonial powers, if they're better, so we strive to be like them, then there's never any hope of unity within a country, within a society, and the area at large.
Yes, well, Surya, we've got about 2 or 3 minutes to go before we close off the broadcast, but just some final thoughts from you.
Some final thoughts. I wish I could give you final thoughts that are reassuring, that can calm you, but all I can say is to yourself, to anybody listening to this, I think the first thing we need to do is to build awareness. The second thing we need to do is to take pride in ourselves as individuals, as an Egyptian, as an Ethiopian, as a Sudanese. And once we regain that independence within ourselves as an individual, then we can share it with those around us and with the country in itself. And it's only at that time that we can confront the enemies, be it the leaders that have been selected to rule over us, or be it the foreign powers that are actually coming for us. So I think it all starts with the self, and that's the only thing that I try to do for myself, and it's the only thing that I can share at this point.
Well, Surya, thank you very much for that, and we certainly do appreciate your time with us. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking
My
with
pleasure.
You and connecting with you, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, and you too. Thank you.